It is Wednesday, March 9th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jesse Singer, senior strategist and head writer at Transportation Alternatives, author of There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. Also on the program today, Chernobyl knocked off its energy grid using generators to cool its nuclear fuel. Supposedly, no reason to worry. Meanwhile, Ukrainian refugees reach 2 million, 1 million of whom are children. More civilian escape routes are created. Negotiations continue. Poland has MiG fighters for Ukraine, but can't get them there. Can't get them from here to there, from there to there. U.S. bans Russian oil imports as EU outlines a path to be free of Russian fossil fuels by 2030. Congress scrambles to avoid a Friday government shutdown as we welcome back earmarks. That's a good thing. Speaking of good thing, Congress passes postal reform bill, unshackling unfair postal service requirements for funding. We'll talk more about that. Texas man convicted by a grand jury over January 6 charges. And Enrique Tarrio, the former Proud Boy head, also indicted now on January 6 charges. The Don't Say Gay bill passes in Florida. Awaits DeSantis's signature. It'll be coming. Missouri lawmaker introduces legislation to ban out-of-state abortions. Your abortion restriction or ban travels with you, is what she wants. Lastly, new study shows that half of U.S. adults were exposed to harmful levels of lead as children. Half. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Sam Cedar here. Emma Vigeland is on vacation for a couple of days. Today, I am told by one of our IMer, marks the 1 year of having a sub button on Twitch. Apparently now you can monetize on that platform, so you can subscribe. Not only you can be a subscriber on YouTube, but you can subscribe on Twitch. All you do is hit that Twitch button, and apparently you don't have to pay anything, right? It's just like part of your Amazon price. Is that the way it works, Dorsey? Okay, Dorsey's not going to talk about it. Talk about poggers. Says Nug Wrangler.
Nice.
We're going to talk about that lead story just briefly before we get into other stuff. Longtime listeners of this program will know that, I mean, actually, there's two sort of like of my bailiwicks today. The Postal Reform Act reverses the 2006, I can't remember what the name of the act was, moved primarily by Republicans, although everyone was on board to more or less, to some extent, a bill in 2006, a law, that forced the Postal Service to fund its health care for retirees 75 years out. So in other words, it had to fund healthcare for people who will work at the post office who are not even born yet. There is no government agency, no private business, no NGO. There is no entity in the world that has that type of requirement. It caused the Postal Service to be in the red, I guess is what they call it, right? When you don't have, when you're running a deficit for years of billions of dollars. That has been fixed. And my understanding is, and the people are looking at that, the postal banking is protected within that act. I'm also hearing somebody's headphones. So if you, whatever that, wherever that sound's coming from, we got to just take care of that. And then this other story, this other bailiwick of mine has been lead and the unintended consequences of things like lead gasoline. And on some level, this is an interesting analogy to what we're going to be talking about with Jesse Singer. As you know, in this country, leaded gasoline was outlawed largely around, I think it was 1972 when it was outlawed. I think there was different places. I can't remember what it was nationally, but in different locales. There's a new study that has shown that over 170 million U.S.-born people who were adults in 2015 were exposed to harmful levels of lead as children. Researchers used blood lead level, census, and leaded gasoline consumption data to examine how widespread early childhood lead exposure was in the country between 1940 and 2015. So children born in the U.S. between 1950 and 1981 had blood lead levels higher than the CDC threshold. In other words, they had lead poisoning. Researchers found significant impact on cognitive development. On average, early childhood exposure to lead resulted in a 2.6-point drop in IQ. Now, IQ isn't necessarily the best measure of intelligence. We know that. But it, when it's measured against itself, it becomes a, you know, a way of measuring. It's also an easier one. But we also know that there were massive crime drops across the country, and in fact, this tracks internationally, 20 years out from where lead gasoline was banned. I mean, this is fascinating. And incidentally, we're seeing this in the context of Flint, right? Where there was massive lead poisoning from the water, where you have an explosion of special needs education requirements in Flint because it affects child development, it affects brain development, it affects brain functioning, and not just in the moment, but years and years later. And I don't know if we'll ever know, but if you accept, well, there is a correlation, 20 years out, drops in crime across the country, internationally, wherever. But if you accept a causal connection between crime and lead exposure, there's a whole spectrum of behavior that exists between not having a lead-exposed brain and one that is, that leads to criminal or antisocial behavior. Atreos over at Eschaton posted, he said, you know, he doesn't think that young people understand how much of bar fights, the existence of bar fights was a regular thing when we, people our age, we're in our 20s. And I just assumed it was still the same thing, but I just figured, you know, I'm not in that scene anymore, so I don't know about it. But when I was, you know, in my 20s, or late teens, frankly, walk into a bar in Worcester, Mass. It was like it was an aggro fest. It was like, could I get out of here without getting beat up? And it was just every type of bar. Newbury Street in Boston was like just a rolling brawl every weekend. And it was all people in their early 20s. And apparently it's not like that anymore. And so it speaks to a couple of issues. One is the unintended consequences. And certainly the people understood the implications of lead. We've gone through that. They understood. I mean, the houses, the factories where lead was used were considered literally madhouses. But it also speaks to externalities and who pays the price for things that create profit for other people. That's basically the theme in many respects of Jesse Singer's book, Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. We will get to that in just a moment. Yesterday, Joe Biden delivered remarks at the White House. Two major developments, or I guess big pieces of news in terms of the response by the international community to what's going on with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. One is that Poland has, I don't know, I think it's almost close to two dozen MiG fighters, Ukraine Army, or I guess Air Force, trained on MiG fighters. So to get them, you know, American built fighters doesn't make any sense. Poland has almost two dozen MiG fighters that they essentially want to give to the Ukrainians. The problem is Poland doesn't want to send them directly from Poland because then it can be taken by Russia as a Polish participation in the conflict. Poland wanted to send them to an American airbase to then send them to Ukraine. America does not want to be seen as participating. And I think these are good reasons because we don't want to expand or give Russia an excuse to expand the war to include the U.S. or NATO, both because we don't want World War III and because it diminishes pressure, domestic pressure on Putin if he can make the argument that the U.S. is actually involved in this or, you know, NATO. So they're trying to figure out, apparently Kamala Harris is headed there with, I would imagine, a lot of military people, trying to figure out how they can get these planes to Ukraine without, I don't know how they do that. Maybe they just pretend somebody comes in and steals them. Maybe you just get like, isn't this where like tough guys on like Fox News go and they say they're going to steal some jets? Where's Mike Bongino, whatever that guy's name is? Why doesn't Bongino get a crew of people like Kevin Sorbo and get a whole crew of like, tough misfits and go over and steal the MiG jets? Fly them into Ukraine. Here's Joe Biden announcing the other response by the international community. This is it's going to increase the price of gas in this country. It's an international market. It'll mean it'll create greater demand on other suppliers. But here is, but we are also just, I think, a couple of weeks away from OPEC's deal to diminish production over the past 2 years, in which case we may see them increase production. Although my understanding is that Saudi Arabia is not answering the phone. because they're still mad that Joe Biden doesn't appreciate the guy who chopped up a journalist being the head of their country. But here is Biden speaking about a ban on Russian fossil fuel import.
We're banning all imports of Russian oil and gas and energy. That means Russian oil will no longer be acceptable at U.S. ports, and the American people will deal another powerful blow to Putin's war machine. This is a move that has strong bipartisan support in Congress and, I believe, in the country. Americans have rallied to support the Ukrainian people and made it clear we will not be part of subsidizing Putin's war. We made this decision in close consultation with our allies and our partners around the world, particularly in Europe, because a united response to Putin's aggression has been my overriding focus, to keep all NATO and all of EU and our allies totally united. We're moving forward this ban, understanding that many of our European allies and partners may not be in a position to join us. The United States produces far more oil domestically than all the European countries combined. In fact, we're a net exporter of energy. So we can take this step when others cannot. But we're working closely with Europe and our partners to develop a long-term strategy to reduce their dependence on Russian energy as well. Our teams are actively discussing how to make this happen. And today, we remain united. We remain united in our purpose to keep pressure mounting on Putin and his war machine.
The administration has done a good job, I think, in maintaining some semblance of cohesion amongst all the allies here. And to be clear, this is a good example of why the idea of us upping production would drop prices. Because we're already selling oil and natural gas. We're exporting it already as a country. The bottom line is, when you hear people talk about increasing U.S. oil production or natural gas as a way of dealing with a situation like this, they're implying this is a national security issue. Americans are paying more money. And in that instance, your response should be, I agree, which is why we should be nationalizing all of these things. They should not be in private hands, because in private hands, what's going to happen is those private entities that are selling and exporting whatever fossil fuel they're exporting, they're going to say, well, you're going to have to pay me more money if I'm not going to meet that contract over there, and I'm going to meet the contract domestically. You're going to pay me more money. Okay, we'll pay you more money. What should happen is we should nationalize every interest that we have in this country of every drop of oil that is being extracted, every bit of coal that's being extracted, every bit of natural gas that is being extracted. In fact, all of our energy should all be nationalized. You're going to see the behavior of a lot of people in Congress change very quickly if that were the case. Would change a lot of things. But if someone's going to push the argument, we need to drill more because it's a national security issue, then the obvious response is, then we should nationalize it. It is national security. We should nationalize it. But that won't happen. Quick word from our sponsor, and then we'll be back with Jesse Singer. Speaking of getting off of fossil fuels, the second part of the IPCC report dropped recently. Things are looking pretty bleak. Now, nothing we do as individuals will really ultimately have the type of impact that we need to have, but it's still a good thing to do. It is part of the solution. And My Solar Nerd sponsored this program before. They are on a mission, which is fairly simple, which is to help people like you find the best solar program for your home and make the transition easy and smooth as possible. So here's the deal. It is very difficult to figure out exactly what you're supposed to do if you want to go solar. Right now is the time to do it because there's a 26% tax credit. That extension exists because of COVID, but it's going to end at the end of this year. It's going to drop down to 22%. So a longtime fan of this show who was working for other solar outfits saw that some of these were a little bit predatory, became a consultant. They have a long time experience in the solar industry. And essentially, if you're one of those people, you're a homeowner, you want to convert to solar, maybe it's a new build and you want to have solar, you're just not sure how to go about it. My Solar Nerd basically functions as your general contractor when it comes to solar installation. Helps you with all the possible options that you may not be aware of. You can retrofit a home with solar panels for almost no money down. Most homeowners that switch over to solar see significant savings starting in their first year. Again, this is a function of the solar investor tax credit. And what they do is they analyze your usage. They find the best equipment for your needs. They determine the incentives and financings that you may qualify for. And then they basically project manage the entire process between you and the installers, obtaining the permits, et cetera, finding where the finance are, telling you which forms you got to fill out, et cetera, et cetera. You should not wait on this. Like I say, some of those tax credits and incentives are sunsetting. The 26% tax credit drops down to 22% next year before going away. If a project is completed by the end of this year, qualifies for that 26%. Some markets are prone to power outages, and so they may qualify for off-the-grid backup solutions. And Majority Report listeners will get a $200 gift card upon installation of their solar system if they use My Solar Nerd's services. So go to mysolarnerd.com, fill out the inquiry form now. Make sure you select the Majority Report listener for how you heard about My Solar Nerd to receive $200 gift card upon installation. That is mysolarnerd.com. We'll put that link in the show description. Check it out. Also, if you are anywhere within several miles of New York City or Brooklyn, tomorrow night I will be doing my first public appearance in the 2020s. And that will be at the Bell House for the Bituation Room. Francesca, Fiorentini. I'm going to call her Francesca when I get there. She'll be at the Bell House. It's at 8 p.m. 7 p.m.? 7 p.m. Comedian Matt Lieb will be there. And New York City Council member Tiffany Caban will be there. And I'll be there. And Francesca will be there. So check it out. Bell House, Brooklyn, tomorrow night. All right, going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Jesse Singer. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Jesse Singer. She's senior strategist and head writer at Transportation Alternatives and author of her recent There Are No Accidents, The Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster, Who Profits and Who Pays the Price. Jesse, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk about let's just start with how you came to work in this field and to write this book. I know you worked with the late great Wayne Barrett, who was a guest on this program many times over the years and years. How is it that you got interested in this particular topic?
My path to writing this book starts when I was an investigative journalist working with Wayne around 2006, when my best friend was killed on a bike and pedestrian path on the west side of Manhattan. He was killed by a driver who had accidentally turned onto the path. The driver was drunk, was speeding, proceeded down the path until he killed my best friend. But the path to me writing this book, I actually get here 11 years later, when a driver rented a truck and intentionally followed the exact same path as the driver who killed my best friend. That man killed 8 and severely injured 11 in a vehicular terrorist attack. But he'd followed the exact same path, and it started me kind of asking big questions about what had happened. And when I looked into it, I found that other people had died the exact same way. And the drivers had all behaved different. You know, some were drunk, some were lost, some were distracted. But the result was the same. Nothing was done because those were all accidents. And then after this terror attack, the city and state got together and they barricaded every entrance to this bike and pedestrian path. They made the accident and the terror attack impossible to occur again. And that's when I realized that accidents were sort of this magic, willful ignorance. And that's what drove me to look into the numbers. And what I found was incredibly disheartening.
And I have to say, like, this is a story about externalities. This is a story about, in some respects, privatizing profits and socializing costs. And this is a story about just decisions we make as a society. I mean, you could draw an analogy to the idea of, like, you know, we just increased child poverty by 41% by ending the child tax credits. Like, in other words, we know how to do certain things. It's just we're making decisions not to. And sometimes these decisions are sort of it's not transparent that we're making these decisions.
I think you're totally right. And I think that's why we get with something like accidental death into like unseen crisis territory. You know, no one's talking about this, even though we're dying by accident more than any time in history. And the numbers are rising rapidly. In 2019, it was 173,000 Americans killed. In 2020, it was more than 200,000. And part of the reason, exactly like you were saying, is that these are supposed to be random, unpredictable things. But if that were true, then accidental death would be randomly distributed across the U.S., and it's not. Black and Indigenous people die by accident most often. People living in poverty die by accident most often. And that's especially true for accidents where policy and infrastructure make the difference between life and death. And so we're seeing this, the result of policy decisions and unregulated corporate power leading to unequally distributed risk across the U.S.
You made that point about the jump from 2019 to 2020, but you also write that the overall rate of accidental death since 1992 has it doubled, as I think it was?
I think it's more than doubled. Currently, accidental death is rising much faster than the population. But the 1992 year is kind of interesting because you were talking about the child poverty tax credit. So throughout history, accidental death tracks with income inequality, which was why it was highest in the Industrial Revolution and why it's so high today. And the only way we ever see declines in accidental death is when we protect people. And there's two ways of doing that. So post-World War II, we build out the social safety net and we build a system of regulations. The regulations protect people in pretty obvious ways. You know, you're protected from a corporation because that corporation is regulated. But the social safety net also protects people because then people could afford to protect themselves. You know, you could afford to buy a safer car or not live in an unsafe apartment or not take the most dangerous job. And so after World War II, accidental death falls for decades, but it's been rising since 1992. What I see as the after effects of the defanging of our regulatory agencies and the dismantling of the social safety net.
You're right at one point. Accidents are not a design problem. We know how to design the built environment to prevent death and injury in accidents. And accidents are not a regulatory problem. We know the regulations that will reduce the accidental death toll. Rather, accidents are a political and social problem. To prevent them, we need only the will to redesign our systems, the courage to confront our worst inclinations, and the strength to rein in the powerful who allow accidents to happen. In fact, I mean, you don't like the term, or not just you, but there is a sense that we should not be using the term accidents for these events. You know, we have a longtime listener who's now an expert in these things who gets on me every time I say natural disasters, because there are no natural disasters. The disaster happens when we as a society make decisions to not prepare for nature, essentially.
I think you're totally right. And the language thing's a little tricky, right? Because there's two things going on here. Corporations and government negligence is taking advantage of the fact that we think these things are random. And part of what happens in any given accident is we focus on the last person who made a mistake. And we look to them and they say, oh, they screwed up. I'm not going to be like them. I wouldn't make that mistake. And then we move on. And so these questions of personal responsibility for all of us become a misleading distraction from our ability to solve the problem. Two examples. You're less likely to die by accident if you live in Europe than the United States. But if you live in West Virginia in the United States, you're more likely to die than anyone else in America by accident. So are people in Europe more responsible or people in West Virginia less? No, they're exposed to different conditions. And you can even break that down to like a micro level. Like imagine two speeding drivers, one rich, one poor. They both make the same mistake. They both make the same bad decision to accelerate too much in their car. But the rich driver is more likely to have automatic emergency brakes, which you can pay extra for, installed in their car. And so they're more likely to survive their mistake. And currently, we just don't have a system that requires these really simple ways to help us survive when things go wrong, built into the system.
Well, I mean, when we talk about the number of accidents rising so dramatically since 1992, I mean, rising dramatically, really just over the past, you know, from 2019 to 2020, like are there certain categories of so-called accidents that are more prominently rising than others?
Yes, absolutely. Three major factors are leading the rise. Accidental drug overdoses, accidental traffic crashes, and accidental falls. And I put all those accidents in scare quotes.
And so what has contributed to what has been the policy decisions or maybe the private decisions that are not been mitigated by policy that would have otherwise been mitigated by policy decisions that have led to those? I mean, do we know, or is it like, I mean, how do we disentangle those things?
Well, I mean, it's certainly complicated because it's hard to see the way that like a fall has to do with an opioid overdose. But they're related in the sense that we're not protecting people where we can protect people. So, you know, fall deaths can be mitigated by, building into our infrastructure, ADA accessibility, ramps and grab bars at every opportunity, where overdose deaths can be mitigated with safe injection sites and naloxone distribution. Part of the traffic crash epidemic we're seeing is an unregulated auto industry where vehicles are getting much, much larger and much more powerful, but no one's controlling for those factors. So you're in this situation where either you're a pedestrian struck by a much more powerful car, or you're a person living in poverty driving an older, less powerful, less safe car and getting struck by these much larger vehicles. So the common ground here is both the failure of regulation and the failure to give people the opportunity to protect themselves, but also this lack of consideration that we just need to protect people from their mistakes rather than expecting them to somehow be perfect.
Well, I want to tease these different things out, because the second one you're talking about, it's sort of almost like a societal disposition. And I wonder if that has actually changed as much as, you know, as much as we're just simply not aware of what's happening on the other side of the equation, right? Like, I mean, for instance, so there's a profit motive to build these bigger vehicles because they get a higher markup on them. And so we could see in the data that there haven't been necessarily a rise in the amount of times that someone bumps into someone else, you know, that someone drives their car or their vehicle into another person. It's just those end up being more creating more fatalities, and or they don't, or maybe there has been a rise in how many times people drive their car into somebody because they're less likely to see a person because they're up here in their SUV and the person's down here. Whereas like if I'm in my, you know, tiny, you know, not tiny, but my normal size Nissan, I'm down, you know, sports car or hatchback or whatever, you know, I have a better line of sight to, you know, maybe a kid or maybe I have more stopping power with a smaller car because I don't have such a massive vehicle that's, you know, going down the street. Is that, so that's one element of it, right? That's going on there. Has the attitude towards blaming individuals changed, or is it just that we have more, there's just more opportunity for accidents to take place because the regulatory system, like, I mean, I don't know that people are aware that the regulatory system changed 30 years ago, let's say. You know what I mean? Like the overall regulatory regime, I guess 40 years ago now, when regulations started to assess risk in a different way. I don't know that your average citizen's any more or less aware of that. It's just that they're out there and they're just less protected, and they don't necessarily correlate with the profits that car manufacturers want to make with more dangerous cars.
I think that's absolutely true. And both things are happening, right? The cars are getting bigger. The crashes are getting more severe. The regulatory framework isn't watching or trying to solve those problems. And I think that's an important thing to remember about when people die by accident, is that the path to death is layered. You know, one thing we see is that hospitals are shutting down across rural areas in the United States. And so part of the, you know, we know many of the causes of the opioid epidemic, but one thing that's affecting whether or not you die from an overdose is how far away the nearest hospital is and how quickly an EMT can get to you. And so that's kind of like a good example of how these overall economic trends connect to these micro factors that matter whether you live or die in an accident.
There's a parallel here to COVID, both in terms of like on the protection side and on the risk side. Will you talk
absolutely? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think COVID has made us all micro experts in risk exposure, right? But the story we're often told about COVID is, you know, that risk exposure is a matter of personal choice. You know, your vaccine, your mask. But when it comes down to it, what really defines whether you live or die by COVID is whether or not you have to go to work or you get to stay home, whether your health is already in decline. And so it's a good example of how these layered risks already occur.
Also, I guess like on top of that, too, would be the closure of public hospitals. I mean, we've seen, at least in the context of New York, if you're living in an area where public hospitals have been closed and or defunded in many respects, the death toll is higher as well.
Yes, and that's definitely something that's happening in places like West Virginia, where rural hospitals can't afford to stay open and are shutting down. And so then your transit time to a hospital might be 2 hours. That's not survivable in a lot of accidents.
We should also say that, too, when we talk about, you know, sort of increased deaths by car, essentially. There seems to be like so many different players, if you will, or parties who are profiting on the factors that lead to those higher deaths, right? Like, I mean, you know, the obvious one is the car companies that are are making vehicles that are more prone to, you know, to kill people. But also, it seems to me that commute times are up, which is putting money in the pockets of real estate developers, in the sense that, like, we can charge higher rents in the city, get our workers from the suburbs, they're going to have to drive more. And so they're paying essentially for us to raise our rents, because we're going to need labor here, but they're paying for it in more time in their car. They got to spend more time commuting. They got to pay for their gas, and they also got to pay for their lives.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think we see that in, you know, for example, there's no safer way to get around than public transit. But that is not going to, like, necessarily profit someone, but it's also going to reduce accidental death.
Let's talk about Vision Zero, which has been adopted. Tell us what that is and how we fare with Vision Zero in this country versus other countries.
Vision Zero in the United States is it is a program out of Sweden that essentially says that we have to protect human life at all costs. The version we have in the U.S. is a little less effective because we actually spend a ton of money on enforcement and education, which are largely useless to the problem, instead of spending money to change our infrastructure and re-engineer our roads.
And let's talk about the concept of blame as you talk about it, and consequences versus punishment.
Absolutely. I mean, I think when it comes down to it, punishment is largely an ineffective way to solve the accidental death problem. We aren't particularly responsive to punishment, especially punishment through police enforcement, which is totally random. So we see our getting caught speeding, for example, as a matter of luck, rather than as a matter of, you know, whether or not we were doing something that we will guaranteed get punished for. And so there's this problem that occurs where we're not actually looking at prevention, because I think, again, punishment doesn't prevent anything. It doesn't reduce the harm of our mistakes. It just tries to focus in on personal responsibility as this be-all and end-all solution to when things go wrong.
Let's also talk about the idea of highway stops and police work during this. It's not as effective as people tend to think.
It's not effective at all, actually. There was one study of 33 states and 12 years of traffic stops, and they could find no correlation between whether or not you died in a traffic crash in those places and the level of police enforcement. And again, because police enforcement is a random consequence. You know, you speed 5 days of the week, you get caught one, you think, oh, bad luck, I'll try again tomorrow. So policing as a solution to the accident problem is just focusing on the wrong thing. Because when it comes down to it, our goal should be to prevent harm, not to try and change human behavior. I mean, it is so hard to change human behavior. Think about all the people who've already abandoned their New Year's resolutions, and that's stuff they want to do. Much less a behavior that helps them, like speeding to go faster to work, where we know how to re-engineer our roads so people want to drive faster. Speed governors is a technology that's existed since the 1920s that could prevent a car from exceeding the speed limit. And it can do it autonomously today, reading the actual speed limit signs. But these advancements require regulation. They require controlling our accidental death scenario in a way that looks at protecting people, not punishing them.
The likelihood of me getting a phone call from a libertarian after this interview in our second half of our show, where we take phone calls, and saying, well, we make these type of trade-offs all the time. If we really wanted to end if we really wanted to end these type of things, we could drop the speed limit to 30 miles per hour. What is your response to that? And I know that you just messaged us that you're having some computer issues. So if you cut out, you cut out. But what's your response to that? to that idea that we could just drop the speed limit to 15 miles an hour?
Personally, I'm on the team of protecting human life at all costs. If we can save lives by reducing the speed limit to 15 miles an hour, there will be other costs, but no one will die. And I think that's a beautiful thing, and at least a beautiful attitude to go into this problem, looking at this problem with how can we protect people? And you really see this in the overdose crisis, of a failure to protect people because we're like, oh, it costs too much. It costs us too much in some ethical judgment or some social judgment. You know, and you see the economists of this in these junctures bring out the moral hazard argument. You know, after seatbelts were first regulated, economists were like, seatbelts are a moral hazard because people might be more reckless. And recently, economists have made the argument that naloxone distribution is the same thing, a moral hazard, because people might use drugs more recklessly. And it's, again, these attitudes of blame and judgment that don't solve any problems, where we could be preventing all of these deaths if we simply stepped back from this obsession with personal responsibility and how we can police everyone's behavior and instead just gave them what they needed to survive.
We should say also that same moral hazard argument was deployed by Christian fundamentalists with the HPV vaccine, that by giving that HPV vaccine to young women and girls would increase their sexual behavior. That, incidentally, aside from it being completely nuts as a theory, in practice, it's been also completely wrong. I don't think it's other. I think it's other factors that have lessened teen pregnancy and teen sexual activity. But it shows that there's no correlation there. All right, so let me. What can we do? Like, what are there? What things are there to do? And lastly ask you too about your response there. Is it that we have a sort of organic societal, sense that there should be personal responsibility? Or is this a narrative that is promoted by corporate interests? I mean, you talk about the story of hot coffee, the McDonald's coffee thing. And I'm just familiar with that because I go down and I deal with tort lawyers every couple of times a year in a conference. And there was a movie about that that incident called Hot Coffee that showed that, like, this was not a question of someone's individual responsibility. She was mocked mercilessly, this woman who burned herself from this McDonald's coffee. But there was a lot more to the story, and it was really about McDonald's trying to maximize their profits when it came to coffee by keeping it at a super hot temperature. And there were hundreds of people who got hurt by this. Is this a human characteristic or an American characteristic, or is it something that is being promoted by corporate interests so that they don't have to foot the bill to not put out products or to set up things in such a way that people aren't harmed by them?
I think it's a case of both. I think accidental death like this is terrifying. It scares us. And so we react to it by saying, oh, who can I find to blame? Who's responsible? And that comforts us a great deal. And I think corporations and a negligent government takes advantage of that and essentially creates this narrative where it has to be a matter of personal responsibility if you spill your coffee on your lap, even if the coffee cup is almost designed to fall apart and the coffee is known to be heated well above safe temperatures. And you were asking about what we do about this. And I think the most important point I want to impart is that accidents are simple. This is not cancer. This is not COVID. We know how to solve this problem. We know how to prevent accidental death. It is as simple as putting a pillow between us and our mistakes. And so systemically, what we can do is, you know, refund and revive our regulatory agencies to rein in corporate power and rebuild the social safety net so people can protect themselves. But there's also a lot you can do locally because there are so many ways to prevent accidental death. You know, advocating for traffic calming and public transit expansions are going to reduce deaths on your roads. Advocating for safe injection sites and free naloxone in your city or your town is going to reduce overdose deaths. Fighting for ADA accessibility like ramps and grab bars is going to reduce fall accidents. Safety regulations for fire like sprinklers and automatic self-closing doors absolutely make the difference between life and death in an accidental fire. And all of these solutions require stopping focusing on the last thing that went wrong or the last person who made a mistake, and rather accepting that mistakes are inevitable, but premature death is not. and putting in these systems in place that prevent harm when we inevitably make mistakes.
People should really get the build those muscles in terms of doing this locally, because we're on the verge of having a Supreme Court that is going to completely eviscerate the ability for things like the EPA or the FDA or OSHA or other federal agencies to do this type of work.
You're exactly right.
All right. Well, Jesse Singer, the book is entitled Accidents, the Deadly Rise. Excuse me. There Are No Accidents, the Deadly Rise of Injury and Disaster. Who Profits and Who Pays the Price? We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, definitely worth a read. Fascinating book. And it really understanding this dynamic of, A, when we talk about so-called accidents, being a function of policy, they don't go up. People haven't become more accidental. As people aren't more accidental in America than they are in Europe. People aren't more accidental in West Virginia than they are in, you know, I don't know, Elmira, New York. It's really just a question of how people are situated, how many protections there are, how much abuse corporations are getting away with. And you see it, and look, the lead story is just a perfect example of this. They knew that lead was dangerous. I think the person who actually even like came up with the idea of putting lead in gasoline because it was going to make it more, I think it was going to make it more stable or something like that. It was going to, you know, it was a profit motive. I think was aware, like, wait a second, this could be detrimental. And ultimately, the government has the ability to regulate it. It does. We see crime drop again. There's a lot of evidence that it's associated with it. There's no definitive proof, but we just saw this new report that shows there's definitive, there's proof that, or at least this research makes it pretty clear that there's a pretty strong causal connection between essentially IQ and lead. That's just really a surrogate for other brain development functions. Or brain development. But a book like this is a good way to introduce to people the idea of externalities and the idea of that we are making choices, even if those choices are not obvious. And by we, I mean our society and our government. Really interesting way to get people into like a mode of thought where they start to understand that some of this stuff is, and you look, you know, went through the same thing with the 2008 financial crisis, where people thought there was that people were immiserated by their own failed individual decisions, as opposed to a systemic problem. People didn't realize, like, oh, wait a second. I got this loan. I wasn't quite sure I understood the terms. I didn't. And there was hundreds of thousands of other people in the exact same boat as me. That's not a function of our ignorance. That's a function of the loan officers who failed to do their fiduciary responsibility. It's the reason why we call them loan officers as opposed to just loan salesmen. Because they're not selling us, like, you know, a stereo. I know nobody buys stereos anymore, but that was always the shtick. Like, you go into like Tweeter, et cetera, and they upsell you. You got to get the one with the big subwoofers, man. I never called those guys stereo officer sales. You know, there's a fiduciary responsibility. Banks get federally insured. Anyways, check out that book. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, happy birthday to someone in the Majority Report family, Jamie Peck. I think she's turning like 27 today or something like that. I don't know. It's her birthday. So go wish Jamie happy birthday on Twitter. Also, don't forget Majority Live. Brooklyn show sold out. But you can get a streaming ticket for it. And yes, you'll be able to watch it after the fact. Here's the deal. If you sign up for the AM Quickie, go to amquickie.com. Every day for the next couple of days, really probably until the show, we're including a coupon code that gives you over 50% off the streaming costs. You don't want to miss this. We've got a bunch of different things that are planned. Still searching around for, like, you know, who we're going to invite and crazy stuff. And then, of course, you also have the opportunity to go see us in Boston. We'll push the Boston show after the New York show even more. But I got a special guest lined up for the Boston show who is, let me put it this way. The special guests that you cannot promote, those are the big, big ones. So those are the big, big, big ones. So check that out, Majority Live. Also, I said the Just Coffee. And don't forget, we have merch, shop.majorityreportradio.com. You can check that out as well. And go check out Left Reckoning. Matt, of course, is vacationing in Europe, taking a European vacation. But go back and check out some of that stuff.